Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. Water can run scarce in California, a state really, known for its abundance. We produce much of the country's fresh fruits and vegetables, and all those crops, of course, need water to thrive. There are also roughly 40 million people living here, 10 million more than any other state. And of course, we also rely on water to survive. A record-breaking drought within the past decade reminded us all of just how valuable this resource is. This morning on Insight, water is our big conversation. We'll check in on the state's current storage, learn about forever chemicals that are contaminating the state's groundwater, and preview tomorrow's debut of California water being traded on Wall Street as a futures commodity. But first, where are we right now with the state's rainy season and prospects for rain? Michelle Mead is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Sacramento and has graciously joined us in the past to walk us through Weather 101. Welcome back to Insight, Michelle.
Hi, Randall. Thanks again for having me.
So it has been sunny, dry, and relatively warm for the past few weeks during a time when Northern California should be kicking off its rainy season. How much in the hole are we already this year in terms of rain totals?
So you are correct. We have definitely had a slow start to our water year. The state as a whole is below that 50% of average. Which, of course, people are always like, oh my God, that's a terrible thing. And it is. We definitely don't like to start out this way. But we are in a La Nina this year. And like we talked about previously, La Nina tends to have a blocking pattern or basically a ridge off the West Coast that deviates the storms north of us. And so far this year, that's what's been happening outside of the mid-November storm that we had.
Yeah, so that high pressure builds just off the coast and it pushes all the storms to the north and maybe to the south of us, but mostly to the north of us.
Yeah. North and east, yeah. So We the closer it is to the coast, the less precip we get. So when it moves back towards the west or more into the central Pacific, that's when it allows the storms to actually impact us, or if it flattens a little bit. And that's looking like it might start happening next week, or this weekend, actually into next week.
The other day we had a pretty warm afternoon. It got into the low 70s. Have we broken any records yet in terms of like how long the dry streak has been for this time of year, or warmth, those sorts of things?
So the warmth, like you said, we did tie or set a couple of records in the valley. That was unfortunately due to those north winds. And because we hadn't seen rain since the middle of November, it actually raised fire weather concerns again. So when we don't have the moisture in the air and we get those north winds, that's what allows those temperatures to jump up like that. As far as the precip and to date, are we the driest on record? We do actually have some statistics that I was looking at. We are so far in the Sacramento area to date, which is what, December 8th, we are the driest on record to this date. Like, yeah. I said, if we weren't expecting that pattern change this weekend, we would be more concerned about that. Redding is the second driest to date, and Modesto is also the first driest to date. So the top.
Definitely cause for concern at this stage of the game. But let's talk about that good news that you have in your forecast that's just a few days away. Is this going to be drenching or just sprinkles?
So it's going to be kind of the door opener for, like I mentioned, more of a significant pattern change. I wouldn't say drenching. It's definitely going to be a welcome sight. And it's also going to bring some snow to the mountains. And typically what we see when we get storms coming in over the weekends is all of our outdoor enthusiasts get very excited and they run up the hill. I do want to caution everybody to make sure that, you take your time, you check the Caltrans sites, because while it's only going to be, 5 or 6 inches up there, when you haven't driven in snow for a while, everyone kind of forgets, we got to slow down. We got Caltrans out there keeping the roads. So, it is looking like it'll be coming in Friday afternoon and evening, and then continuing through the weekend. So, if you are going to go up, try to get up in the morning before things get going.
We might have that storm door open. Good.
Yeah, when we say storm door, it's more typical where we're going to start seeing systems every 3 to 5 days. Right now, nothing is looking like huge, those atmospheric rivers that we like to see, but it's definitely a welcome relief that we're going to start seeing some rain and snow in the forecast.
Final question to you, Michelle. I know the accuracy of forecasts really drop off pretty quickly after about a week or so, but climatology models do show future trends that can be helpful with a much more general picture. Do we have a sense of what we should expect this winter?
So, like I mentioned earlier, we are in a La Nina pattern. When you're looking at climatology and the outlooks for the winter, they're heavily relying on statistics and past patterns. So when we look at La Nina, we've drawn the gamut across Northern California from dry to above average to average. So when you look at those seasonal outlooks, you'll see nothing over Northern California. And basically I-80 South will see the potential for at or below average precipitation. So basically what they're saying is because we're so dependent on where that ridge sets up, we're kind of up in the air right now as to what kind of winter we will see. The Pacific Northwest is expected to see above average. We are in that no color, which means I always like to say, get out your dartboard, because it's 33.3% of below, 33.3% of normal, or 33.3% of above normal. So the seasonal outlooks, like I said, aren't really good at determining those storm by storm potential. That's where our job as the short-term forecaster comes in. So,
well, let's hope we set some La Nina records on the wet side of all of those statistics. Michelle Mead is the meteorologist in charge at the National Weather Service in Sacramento. We always enjoy having her on the show, and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. Enjoy the rain.
Oh, yes. No, I will. The California Department of Water Resources, or DWR, is constantly checking the forecast and considering long-range models. It's responsible for regulating how much water is stored in the reservoirs, how much gets sent to farmers, and a variety of other water issues. Chris Orok is the information officer for DWR and joins us now with a snapshot of where we stand in terms of our water storage and supplies. Welcome, Chris. Great to have you here.
Good morning.
So the first snowpack check will be at the end of the month, right?
Correct. December 30th there's some before then. The one that the media comes to, that the public typically knows about, Phillips Station snow survey, will be on December 30th.
Yeah, but the snowpack is constantly monitored with electronic sensors, correct?
Correct. We have 130 different what we call electronic snow pillars that are out there, measuring everything from snow depth to water content, precipitation. And then every month we measure 260 manual snow courses across the Cascades and Sierras in a cooperation with a wide variety of agencies and private companies, water districts. So that's usually done within 3 or 4 days of the first of every month, January through May.
Uh-huh. Early in November, we had some dustings in the Sierra. Is that all gone by now?
No, it's not. In fact, I was just up at Phillips Station last week, looking at the site, talking to the landowner up there, and there was almost 2.5-3 feet of snow in the field that we measure left over from those storms in early November.
Yeah. So it's, at this point anyway, it's not one of those years where Jerry Brown walks out there with a dry ground.
We're hoping not. California's weather has become very extreme, not just year to year, but within any given year. If you look last year, December was the 10th wettest December, or it was the wettest December in the last 10 years. So we got a lot of rain and snow last December, but then February was historically dry. It was probably the driest February in the last 50 to 100 years. In fact, they didn't receive 1 inch of precipitation in all of San Francisco for the month of February, which has never happened before.
Wow. How much, Chris, does the state rely on snowpack for fresh water?
Snowpack is about a third of our fresh water supply in California. So you have that three-legged stool. You have our water storage through our reservoirs, which are fed by the snowpack, but also fed by rain. We have groundwater, and then we have that snowpack, which we call the frozen reservoir. What we like to see is a snowpack that is deep, that is filled with water, that's very cold. So if you look in 2019, was a great year for us. We had the fifth best snowpack on record, but it was a very cold snowpack. So if you remember, some of the ski resorts were open through July 4th. Right. It was a very slow melt-off, slow runoff, which allowed that water to go in our reservoirs and be retained for storage and use, instead of having to be let go for flood control purposes. That storage has carried over the last 2 years and helped us out in these dry periods.
Yeah, 2019 was about as ideal as it could get for DWR, correct?
It was great as far as the snowpack and water storage, yes.
Yeah, so some of that is still in the reservoirs, and we're entering this year how?
So we're at about 86% of water storage across the state as of the beginning of December. That's when we usually look at the numbers. That's 18.1 million acre feet in our major reservoirs and storage. As compared to last year we were at 24 million acre feet. So down a little bit from last year, but we had a dry year last year. Yeah. The storage in Southern California is actually doing really well. A lot of the reservoirs down in Southern California are above 80% of historical average.
Wow. Help us understand reservoirs in the state. Some are run by your department, but not all of them, right?
No, in fact, the majority of reservoirs are not run by DWR. We have the state water project facilities that we operate, but then there's also federal dams. There's dams that are owned down to homeowners associations. Farmers own their own dams, and then also utilities, PG&E, Southern California Edison, water districts, irrigation districts, a wide variety of entities own dams in California.
And Folsom is one of those federal dams, correct?
Folsom and Shasta are the two biggest federal dams, uh-huh. Yes.
And when you say the State Water Project, you're talking about the aqueduct system that sends water down to Southern California and some of the different water agencies?
Right. And the State Water Project starts up at Orville Reservoir, and that's owned and operated by DWR. We have different facilities down through the Central Valley into Southern California, and the State Water Project ends at a reservoir. Well, our southernmost reservoir is Paris down in Riverside. So we have facilities all along the way.
Uh-huh. DWR recently told farmers to expect just 10% of requested water allocations for the coming year. What does that mean exactly?
So the state water contractors are allowed a certain amount of water. We know that given on a conservative basis, what we have in storage and what we're projected as far as the precipitation through the year. So that's a first allocation. It'll be revisited every month of how much of their how much that they're allowed to get, a percentage of that is allocated at every allocation.
And then they have other sources like groundwater, or you mentioned some of them even have their own retaining ponds.
Right.
Okay, so the most recent drought, as you know, was brutal. What did DWR learn from those years that could help us should a current dry streak turn into something more serious?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is SGMA, the Sustained Groundwater Management Act, which was passed in 2014, and it helps us better manage and requires locals to manage their groundwater aquifers, and they've been submitting plans, and there's been comments on plans and how they're going to manage those. But it also brought into that conservation is a way of life in California. We have to continue to be judicious in our usage of water down to the personal use of it. I mean, I always like to say, turn off that faucet when you're brushing your teeth. Only run your dishwasher and your washing machine when you have full loads. You know, you don't need to water your front lawn twice a day, every day.
Or you don't even need a front lawn.
What, say again?
Or you don't even need a front lawn.
Case in point, I don't have a front lawn anymore. I let my front lawn go, and I don't do that anymore as a personal choice. But making those small changes now, because it's not if another drought's going to come, it's when that next drought comes. And
yeah.
So making small changes now in our personal behaviors makes it so we don't have to make large changes when that next drought happens.
Yeah. Chris Orrock is the information officer for the California Department of Water Resources. We appreciate you taking time to give us the water snapshot of where we stand right now in the state.
Thanks, Randall.
And up next, California's hidden water storage. We'll dig into the state's groundwater situation, what's being done to protect it, and learn about contaminants known as forever chemicals. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, and we're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation this morning is focused on California water. As we heard in the last segment, much of this precious resource is stored in the form of snow in the Sierra Nevada through the winter, which then melts and gradually fills the state's reservoirs throughout the summer. During dry years, the state leans on what has historically been a very reliable source of water that is stored underground. Over the decades, and definitely during the previous drought, that water bank saw more withdrawals than deposits, which led to large areas of the state actually dropping in elevation as the ground that was supported by vast reserves underneath subsided as these basins were drained. This and other problems with groundwater storage set off alarms that led to a change in management rules at the state level. Ellen Hennick is the director of the Water Policy Center at the Public Policy Institute of California. That's a nonpartisan research group, and joins us today to help us understand where we are in terms of managing the state's groundwater supplies. Ellen, great to have you here.
Great to be here.
So California adopted this landmark law in 2014. It's called the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. We just heard Chris Orrock reference it as SGMA, right? That's the shorthand for it, the S, G, M, and A there. And unless you live in an area where this has been a major issue, you may not know much about it. So help us understand what this law changed and where we are now 6 years later.
So what this law did, and I want to underscore that it was really a landmark piece of legislation. If you think about it, California's Modern Water Code was enacted in 1913, and it didn't really cover groundwater. It took 101 years for us to really have a state law on groundwater. And we were the last Western state to have a state regulation around groundwater management. So it's a big deal. And it also is kind of unique in really focusing on local management and kind of keeping the responsibility at the local level, with the idea, as with a lot of California water management, that, you know, we're a big state, conditions vary locally, and locals are in charge of it. But what the state set up was requirements and a timeline for local water users to form agencies at the local level, and then develop groundwater sustainability plans, long-term plans, and then start implementing those. And once they submit the plans, they've got 20 years to kind of get to sustainability.
And we're at the point right now where some of the most severely drained aquifers, plans for those have to be in place?
Correct. So January 31st was the deadline for submitting plans for what the state calls critically overdrafted basins. And that includes a lot of the basins in the Central Coast area, sort of the, you know, our strawberry and lettuce and wine baskets on the coast, as well as the large San Joaquin Valley, the southern half of
the Central Valley, just sort of south of Sacramento, all the way down to Bakersfield, which is a major agricultural area.
When these basins get drained to the point that they were during the big drought, who's most affected? Is it residential customers, farmers? Who really gets hit by this?
So, you know, really everybody gets hit by it in some different ways. And I think, you know, some of the most difficult immediate impacts are for the folks who depend on shallow domestic wells or very small community water systems for their drinking water supplies. There are a lot of those in the San Joaquin Valley, a lot of those communities, and they tend to be low-income communities to begin with and don't have the resources to fix that problem often on their own. And during the last drought, we saw, you know, over 2,500 domestic wells go dry, as well as a number of small community systems that were at risk.
It's disproportionately communities of color.
Correct. Especially in the San Joaquin Valley, especially Latino communities, a lot of them are farm worker communities.
I think we all remember seeing video of these families who have no water coming out their taps, going to a truck that would come by once a day or once a week to, you know, fill up large containers. It was really dire in those situations. Is that what led then to this 2014 law?
So I think that was a piece of it. And, you know, it's important to know that wells can go dry even if there's not, you know, a long-term overdraft. Droughts can do that on their own too. But, you know, that was an important near-term impact. But, you know, another one you mentioned in your introduction to this discussion, which is land sinking. You started to see in some places the land sinking, and along with it, some major damage to infrastructure, including, you know, can affect local things like bridges that go over canals, things like that, roads, flood control systems, but also some of our major water infrastructure. So the big aqueduct that goes down, you know, if you cross over I-5, you pass it down in the area around Tracy, the California Aqueduct, that has been sinking, and also the Fryant-Kern Canal on the east side of the San Joaquin Valley, which is a major aqueduct, that has lost about 60% of capacity in the southern part of that canal. So that's a big deal, just as part of the water system gets affected. And you also saw a lot of irrigation wells go dry. And, you know, that's a big cost for agriculture as well. So a lot of effects. I would say that, you know, it's not just local effects, because these aqueducts, when they sink, that affects water that is going far away. So it even can affect folks as far south as San Diego.
Yeah. And we're not talking the land sinking by a couple of inches or centimeters. We're talking about feet.
In some places it was multiple feet. That's correct. Yeah. You know, and that's a kind of thing that continues on after, you know, they're sort of, it takes some time for that to stop, even if you end the overdraft. So there's still some land sinking occurring in some places. And this is going to continue until we really get our basins into balance.
Once the land is dropped or subsided, can it ever be, you know, lifted back into place? Or has that storage capacity been permanently diminished?
It depends a little bit on the local circumstances. You know, there is groundwater basins. What California is lucky in the sense that we do have groundwater basins. They're kind of living basins. You can, you know, you can add water, you can treat it like a reservoir. And so in a lot of places, you do see some kind of, you know, a bit of fluctuations in relation to that. But the kind of subsidence we're talking about here is mainly permanent. So it means you've got a build around it, and, you know, figure out how you're gonna adjust.
Aside from a series of really great storms coming in over several years, how do we recharge these basins? Are there plans to get water back in the ground?
So one of the really, I think, positive things that we're seeing in an early positive sign with this new law is that interest in doing everything we can to capture water that's not needed by somebody else in the system and get that into the ground. There was already a lot of very innovative groundwater storage or groundwater banking that we were doing in California, especially in places like the San Joaquin Valley. You know, sort of people come from all over the world to look at how people are managing groundwater in Kern County for that reason, but there's more potential. And now all these plans that were submitted, they're all looking for opportunities for getting more water into the ground.
Can we do it with treated sewage? Is that a reliable source? Is there enough of that to recharge these basins?
This is kind of back to the idea that there are a lot of different local circumstances. So in some places, yes. And actually, you know, talk about kind of examples that are you know, models for folks outside of California too. Orange County was an early innovator in taking highly treated wastewater. You know, it's so clean that actually they have, you know, you would have to add some chemicals back into it in order for it to be balanced tap water. But they're taking that highly treated water and recharging it. They have groundwater basins that they a basin that they manage very actively. So that's been going on for really since the late 2000s. And now you're seeing more and more places that have that opportunity to do that. It kind of depends on the circumstances. In big ag areas, there's not the amount of treated wastewater is not nearly enough relative to the gap right now. So resources are needed.
We just heard from the Department of Water Resources that farm allocations of stored water will be at 10%. Of course, that number will likely change over the course of the winter. So that means that these farmers will either be relying on their own reservoirs or groundwater. What are the rules around how much water a farmer can take out of the ground? I imagine that's part of this whole complex law.
That is part of this law. But I would say that it's not, you know, the plans have been submitted, implementation has started, but the law did not say you have to end groundwater overdraft overnight. It gives you these 20 years to do this. And a lot of the planning areas now are in very early discussions about that exact question of, are we going to put individual limits on pumping or not. The local agencies that were created have that authority, but it's harder to get people energized around that than it is around trying to find ways to recharge the groundwater basins. So there's still work in progress on the demand, what we call the demand management side, how you're going to manage demand.
I was covering this back in 2013, 2014, when it was, the forefront of creating laws. And a selling point in some communities, Ellen, for developing a robust groundwater management plan was that they didn't want the state coming in and doing it for them, while others may actually want oversight and support. Can you give us some insight into this dynamic?
So this is the key kind of regulatory aspect of SGMA. As I said, you know, the law really calls on locals to step up and put together these plans and organize. But there is a backstop. And the backstop is that if you fail miserably at doing that at the local level, the state water board can come in and take over the basin for you and do it in your place. And I think, you know, in the regions where I've been working on this, especially in the San Joaquin Valley, you know, most folks do not think that's a preferred alternative. And so it's very motivating to try to develop a plan that is going to pass muster. You know, that doesn't mean everybody is going to be happy with it. And there is a robust sort of public comment process. And I think, you know, right now the plans are actually under review with the Department of Water Resources and which is kind of looking at have the plans kind of met all of the criteria that were and requirements. And they can go back to them to ask for, you know, adjustments and fixes. I think everybody recognizes that we could not expect perfection this is a heavy lift for locals. A lot of them didn't have any of the data you needed because it wasn't something that was managed at a local level before. So, you know, there's also an expectation, there's a requirement that they have to submit updated plans in 5 years. So I think, you know, we have to kind of look at the key being making sure that there aren't really undesirable, unreasonable impacts in the near term of excess pumping. And one of those concerns is precisely around community wells and whether those will have water in them, especially if we're in a drought again.
Yeah, just briefly, Ellen, moving forward, people surrounding this topic, what are they most hopeful for and what are they most concerned about?
I think people are really hopeful that this is going to put us on a path toward long-term sustainability. I think everybody recognizes that groundwater is a really vital resource for California, and we are lucky enough to have these kind of living basins that we can work with. And there's been a lot of progress already. I got to say that if we're in a long dry period, that's going to just make it so much harder because the opportunities for adding supplies with recharge are going to be less. And that means the need to manage demand by pumping less and reducing acreage are going to be bigger.
And that's the big concern, that we'll hit a real dry spell and throw everybody off, I guess. Ellen Hanek is the director of the Water Policy Center. That's at the Public Policy Institute of California, a nonpartisan research group. Ellen, thank you for shedding some light on this issue, which is, it's complicated well beyond what we just talked about.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Clearly, water is a valuable commodity, as we just heard from Ellen. I mean, after all, without water, there is no life as we know it. Water is one of the first elements we look for on other objects in the universe to determine whether life may exist. In California, because of its scarcity, the law of supply and demand has kicked in, with water debuting as a futures commodity on Wall Street tomorrow. Let's now hear from Matthew Fox. He's a markets reporter at Business Insider and had a story this week on water being traded much in the same way as gold and oil is. Welcome to Insight, Matthew.
Hey, Randall. Thanks for having me.
So you really know the markets. I mean, you were a manager for individual stock portfolios at a wealth management firm before you started doing writing for Business Insider. Help us understand the launch of water's futures contracts.
Sure, yeah. This has been in the works for quite some time. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange announced their intent to launch the ability to trade futures contracts on water back in September. And it's tied to California Water Index, which tracks the spot price of water, which was launched about 2 years ago. So I think Wall Street, and specifically the CME group, which helps facilitate futures contracts trading, saw a real opportunity to launch the ability for agricultural farmers and people to be able to hedge their input costs in terms of water as they see, you know, scarcity driven by droughts continue. I think they saw an opportunity for people to be able to trade this commodity.
Yeah. You mentioned that it's tied to the spot price for water. How is that determined? By local water districts?
So the index is tracking weighted average transactions among mostly agricultural farmers. It's tied to five underlying water basins where much of the transactions occur. But the thing is, you know, I think the launch of the index and the launch of the futures contracts will actually give farmers something to point to in the future to give them a more solid understanding of what the current price is for, you know, one per acre foot of water.
Is this mostly water coming out of the ground, like we just discussed, not water that's being delivered by the Department of Water Resources?
Yes, exactly. So this is primarily underground water basins that where the transactions are, the index is utilizing to determine the spot price.
And there's some big players who have bought up significant amounts of land in order to have control over some of these basins. Is it foreseeable that they had this type of commodity trading in mind decades ago when they did that?
It's possible. There's been a lot of speculation in land, you know, land acquisitions that have water rights, you know, especially in the state of California. But what's surprising, I think, about the launch of this futures contract trading is, so far at least, it's a very small market relative to other commodities that, you know, Wall Street is trading day in and day out. You know, for example, right now, the spot price, the contracts are priced in one per acre foot of water. So right now, the current price to buy about 326,000 gallons of water is about just under $500. So, you know, it's surprising in the sense that the actual value right now is pretty small, but, you know, in the long term, they definitely are making the bet that those prices will go up.
And an acre foot of water is what you would have with 1 acre of land covered with 1 foot of water.
Yeah, precisely.
So how does that differ from, say, how oil futures are handled?
Yeah, so when, you know, first back up, what's a futures contract? And that's a legal agreement between two parties to buy a predetermined amount of commodities at a predetermined price at some time in the future. So traditionally, if you're buying an oils future contract and you hold that through expiration, you're going to have barrels of oil delivered to your doorstep, physical barrels of oil. With the water value, with the ultimate value of the water index being so low, the transportation costs to deliver 326,000 gallons of water is through the roof relative to the underlying price. So right now, these futures contracts are, they settle based on financial value. So there's no physical delivery of water. It's more so for, you know, agricultural farmers to hedge their input prices in terms of water.
Yeah. So California water being traded in this way begins tomorrow. Do you foresee this becoming a major player in the markets moving forward?
I don't think so, at least not yet. I think this is really just going to be geared for farmers to have an underlying, you know, price to look at in terms of their input costs. And I think right now the underlying value of the entire California spot water index is just over $1 billion. You compare that to oil or gold, other commonly traded commodities, that's at over $100 billion. And a lot of what has to do with, you know, the value of these futures contracts going much higher is the actual physical transportation of the commodity. So unless the price of water skyrockets to something unfathomable where it makes sense that you can physically transport 326,000 gallons of water and still make a profit, I think it's going to take some time for the underlying value of the markets to really balloon.
Yeah, that expresses it very well. Matthew Fox, markets reporter at Business Insider. Thank you for this insight into something that's going on here in the background that I think has a lot of people going, wait, what? It's going to be traded on Wall Street. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot. Have a good day.
You too. Still ahead, contaminants known as forever chemicals are showing up in water sources throughout California. And we'll speak with a reporter who has tracked this issue. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we are back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and today we are talking about water in California. as communities and farmers depend more on groundwater and those sources are depleted, the quality of the water has come into question. Recently, a spotlight has been shed on a class of contaminants known as forever chemicals. Rachel Becker is an environmental reporter at Cal Matters and joins us today to help us understand what's going on here. Rachel, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So these chemicals have an acronym, PFAS. I'm going to let you pronounce it for what that stands for. And if you could give us some insight into where they originate.
Yeah, so these are industrial chemicals. You might have heard them called forever chemicals or per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFAS for short. And for decades, they've been used to make nonstick and waterproof coatings, so like Teflon or Gore-Tex. They're used to make firefighting foams, food packaging, a ton of consumer goods. So they're everywhere. The problem is that they've been linked to some pretty serious health effects, kidney cancer, testicular cancer, thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis, high cholesterol, high blood pressure in pregnancy, and there's new research also showing some effects on the immune system. So, you know, not great to have in the water, particularly since these chemicals don't really break down in the environment, which is why they have that nickname, forever chemicals.
Right. And so they're mostly dangerous when consumed?
Yeah, there are a couple different routes of exposure. You may be able to inhale them also through household dust and indoor air. There are, you know, occupational risks of exposure for people who work with these chemicals. But in communities with contaminated drinking water, that is a major source of exposure.
And this is one of the reasons why people say if you have a nonstick pan that's full of like scratches and scrapes, you should just get rid of it.
That I don't know. I know that they're in the manufacture of Teflon. I'd have to dig into the literature about how much they're actually released by Teflon. But what I do know is that they can leak into the groundwater from consumer goods that contain these chemicals. You know, food packaging you toss into a landfill, your carpet that has it that got thrown away. And they can leach out of landfills. They can run off from industrial facilities and recirculate through wastewater treatment plants. They can seep into the groundwater from airports and military facilities that use the firefighting foam containing PFAS forever chemicals, although there's a new law that should be phasing that out in California. But basically, over the past couple of years, the State Water Resources Control Board has started ordering testing at wells near these potential sources of contamination, like airports and landfills, and also near wells where these chemicals have been spotted before. And so we're starting to find them in California in a lot of places.
Yeah. Are there hot spots? Are there, you mentioned near airports, but in communities that we would know?
Yes. So they are found all over the state, but they're concentrated in large part in Southern California.
Is there a reason why Southern California, just maybe there's more manufacturing down that way?
Still hard to say because the testing has specifically been ordered at places where the state expects to find contamination. So it's a little too early to say, you know, why there specifically. But so at CalMatters, we analyzed data collected by the state's Division of Drinking Water, and we found that at least 146 public water systems serving nearly 16 million Californians have detected at least traces of the two best-known forever chemicals, and those are perfluorooctanoic acid, or PFOA, and perfluorooctane sulfonate, or PFOS. PFOA, people might have heard of because of the movie Dark Waters. So that's just traces. But the state has established new recommended concentrations of those chemicals based on a recent health analysis. And we found that 200 drinking water wells, or about 15% of those tested, exceeded the recommended levels in at least one round of testing over the past year. And so until now, those levels have just been recommendations. But over this next year, the state's actually going to start cracking down on wells that exceed those concentrations. So it increased the number of wells required to test, and it's going to get a lot tougher. So water systems will now be required to take contaminated wells offline, treat them, or notify their customers. And so that's going to be a big deal.
Right. And is it, as the water level in these wells drops, as we talked about in earlier segments, I imagine the concentration of chemicals in that water is less diluted. So it's showing up at higher levels.
One strategy for reducing these chemicals is to blend it with other sources of water. So some water systems have gotten ahead of the game and have existing blending systems, maybe to reduce other chemicals that we've had consistently problems with in California. So nitrates, for instance, or perchlorate. And other water systems already have treatment systems like granular activated carbon that can also address those chemicals and work for forever chemicals. But many water systems are also looking into installing treatment, and that is pricey. It is really expensive. It could be, you know, $1 million for each well. Some water systems have said it's going to be up to $80 million to install all of the treatment infrastructure they need to treat all of their contaminated wells. The Orange County Water District, which manages the groundwater basin down there, they've estimated up to $1 billion in costs related to the contamination. So, it's expensive. And if water systems don't find a way to pay for this, it's, you know, the risk is that ratepayers are going to be paying for it ultimately, which is why water systems are just starting to sue. They're suing the chemical manufacturers, they're suing firefighting foam manufacturers, they're suing the military. And those are all, you know, still open. So it's really an open question still about who's going to pay to clean this up in California.
Yeah. And whenever the question of who's going to pay, you always have to wonder, will the state or federal government step in on any level?
That is a great question. Right now, the federal government doesn't even have a maximum contaminant limit, which is like the enforceable drinking water standard. They just have a health advisory for lifetime exposure.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if there's a safe level that we know. You know, some chemicals, there's just no safe level, and I wasn't sure where these stood.
We don't know yet. California's health analysis said that the 1 in 1 million risk for cancer from exposure to these chemicals is below the limit of detection with our current testing technologies. So so the levels that the state has set are above the limit of detection, because otherwise you couldn't really test for them accurately. But really, what is the safe level over what period of time is still an active area of research.
Right. You mentioned the fire retardant foam. What about what's dropped on the wildfires from like the large tankers? Because a lot of that is dropped in watersheds.
Mm-hmm. I don't know about the fire retardant that's dropped. I believe that is a different chemical, but I don't know. That's a very good question. I do know that it's in specifically AFFF firefighting foam that is used to quell oil fires, for instance.
And these chemicals, they're still, you said that there's some areas where it's being rolled back, like at airports and such. But in terms of like cookware and everything, it's still perfectly legal for manufacturers to make that, to use these chemicals in the production of those.
Many manufacturers have started phasing them out. So 3M began phasing them out in 2002, and several other large manufacturers began phasing them out over the next couple of years. But when I say them, I'm specifically talking about PFOA and PFOS, which I'm not going to try to pronounce again.
Right.
But there are thousands and thousands of these chemicals. And so, you know, you phase out PFOA and PFOS, another similar, you know, chemical with a slightly different structure is, you know, potentially going to rise and take its place. And because of the way chemicals, new chemicals are regulated in the US, it's really, there's very low, it's hard to say what the health effects are before people start using it.
Yeah. Rachel, finally, in just a few minutes here, or a few seconds, the Are there any water districts or sources in California that the level's just so high they cannot use that water source anymore and now they're out of options?
Well, there are some places where it is astoundingly high, but they are treating it and the treated water is below state limits. So near an airport in Fresno, for instance, it was very, very high levels. But the treated water was, you know, at least according to what they shared with me, was okay. So there are treatments that can help reduce these chemicals. It's just expensive.
Yeah. Rachel Becker, environment reporter at CalMatters. Thank you so much for that insight this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our engineer today, Antonio Munez, and Insight's managing editor is Aram Sarkissian. We're back tomorrow with a brand new show. Look forward to talking with you then. I'm Randall White. Have a great day.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.